Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday, the 15th of September, these are our main stories. President Biden's son, Hunter, has been criminally charged with lying when buying a firearm. The Libyan Red Cross says at least 11,000 people died in the floods that hit the city of Derna. And
they take one word from you and create a story, and you want to pay more, but in most cases they are just lying.
The Syrian refugees looking for missing loved ones and being scammed. Also in this podcast, a man in Brazil is the first to be convicted of attempting a coup in January when key government buildings were ransacked. And
quite common for golfers to be just walking along, minding their own business, playing their golf, and then see a shark fin sort of cruising only a few metres away from them.
The bull sharks that adapted swimmingly to life on an Australian golf course. The US President Joe Biden's son, Hunter, has been indicted on federal gun charges. It is the first ever prosecution of a child of a sitting US president. Our correspondent in Washington, Sean Dilley, told me more about the charges.
They relate to Hunter Biden buying a gun back in 2018. On the 18th of October, he filled out a form that anybody has to fill out from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms. And on that form, he confirmed that he wasn't a user of narcotics or drugs. Now, the prosecution is alleging that he was knowingly not telling the truth then. So there were two charges in relation to the purchase, and then another one that relates to him receiving that gun around a week later on the 23rd of October that year.
Now, what are Mr. Biden's lawyers saying in response to these charges?
Hunter Biden's lawyers, in response to this, are saying, well, hang on a minute, the facts of this case haven't changed in the past 5 years. They're suggesting that it's a political activity from people who support what they say MAGA, Make America Great Again. They're suggesting political pressure from Donald Trump supporters. Just worth noting, when his lawyers refer to the facts have been the same for the past 5 years, they had had negotiations with prosecutors in Delaware already. It had apparently been agreed between them that if he pleaded guilty to two tax cheating charges from 2017 and 18, that he would escape an eventual felony conviction for having the gun. They would use something called a diversion program, that if he abided by certain restrictions, that charge would be dismissed entirely. And so they're suggesting there wasn't anything wrong with that deal. But unfortunately, the judge in the unrelated tax evasion charge at the end of July, well, she had issues with that arrangement.
This is obviously the build-up to the November 2024 presidential election. To what extent do you think the Republicans will be able to use this to tarnish the Biden brand in general?
There are Hunter Biden supporters who believe it's a conspiracy by Donald Trump supporters to use the criminal justice system, and those are the exact same charges that the opposition obviously put forward. But the reality is an unrelated case. Doesn't involve Hunter Biden's dad, Joe Biden. This is exclusively to do with possession of a firearm by Hunter Biden. But that won't stop Donald Trump supporters in particular using it for political capital.
Sean Dilley in Washington. The World Health Organization is warning that survivors of flooding in Libya remain in danger from contaminated floodwater and a lack of medical supplies. The organization has announced it is sending trauma, surgical and emergency equipment to the country. There are growing calls from inside Libya for an inquiry into the disaster. Najwa Wahiba is a spokesperson for Libya's Presidential Council.
It's rarely to happen such strong storm in the Mediterranean, but at the same time, the huge number of victims reflects that there might be a human mistakes, there might be negligence. Also, there were complaints from the towns of the Green Mountain and Derna that there might be delay in delivery of aid. So that's why we asked officially the Attorney General to launch an investigation, and those who are responsible must hold accountable.
Well, the Libyan Red Crescent says the number of people who've died in the city of Derna has now risen to 11,000. And that figure is expected to grow as the recovery effort continues and more bodies are retrieved from the mud. Sebastian Usher has the latest.
Rescue teams from across the region are now searching the mud and ruins of Derna, despite problems with docking in the port and reaching the city by road. Local officials have called for specialist teams and more body bags to tackle the horrifying number of the dead in a race against time to prevent an outbreak of disease. The political divisions that have plagued Libya for years are likely to complicate the process. Many Libyans have blamed politicians, whether in the UN-backed administration in Tripoli or the breakaway authority in Benghazi, for failing to maintain infrastructure, especially the two dams that burst just outside Derna. The head of the World Meteorological Organization has said many casualties could have been avoided if it had even just been a properly working weather service.
Sebastian Usher. Well, our correspondent Anna Foster has just arrived in Benghazi, that's about 150 kilometres to the west of Derna, and spoke to us just before we recorded this podcast.
I think one thing that's really striking is that in the days after a catastrophe on the scale of this one, you'd normally expect to see huge amounts of aid really pouring in. I remember seeing it very quickly after the earthquake in Turkey and Syria just over 6 months ago. But the airport in Benghazi here today, while there has been some activity, some international teams arriving, it is really not the hive that you would expect and that this country needs. There are many injuries, there are many, many thousands more who are displaced. And this country with its infrastructure that is so ravaged by more than a decade now of conflict, a country which doesn't have a single functioning government, which has warring factions in East and West, is in no position to try and deal really with the scale of the disaster that now faces it.
Anna Foster. On January the 1st, 2023, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was inaugurated as the 39th president of Brazil. 7 days later, this was the scene at the presidential palace in Brasilia.
Milhares e milhares de pessoas!
Thousands of supporters of Jair Bolsonaro, the former president and losing candidate in last year's election, broke through police lines and stormed the presidential palace and other key government buildings, ransacking them as they went. Now, the first person to be convicted in connection with the riots in Brasilia has been jailed for 17 years. Our correspondent Katie Watson is in Sao Paulo and told me more.
So the first man to be convicted is Aécio Lúcio Costa Pereira. He's 51. He was filmed in the Senate on January the 8th with a T-shirt calling for a military coup. He also recorded a video praising people who had broken into the Senate. So he is the first of a batch of four people, actually, first off to be tried. And he's been sentenced for 17 years, you've said, for criminal association, staging a coup, violent attack on the rule of law, qualified damage, destruction of public assets, because, you know, I think every single Brazilian for many years to come will remember the ransacked offices, the damaged artwork and the total chaos that we saw take place on January the 8th.
Coming back to the present day, this is the first conviction and sentencing, sending a very strong message, 17 years. There are many more cases to follow, though.
That's right. So three more people are currently in the dock. This is like kind of the first batch, if you like, the Supreme Court is looking at. But there's more than 1,000 people who've been accused of crimes in connection with the riots and expected that those people will be tried before the end of the year. I mean, it's worth pointing out that Aécio Lúcio Costa Pereira, he denied wrongdoing. He said that he believed the protest would be peaceful, but it was a claim that was absolutely rejected by the court. In fact, one judge argued it was impossible for someone with a healthy conscience to believe that after openly inciting a coup, they were there just for a trip to the park, as he said, pretty kind of cynically. But I mean, that's the thing. I think that's what a lot of people will be arguing, that they didn't mean to do this. This was all meant to be peaceful. But there's a lot of evidence showing that the build up to January the 8th and this inciting a coup and trying to justify that the elections were unfair and they were rigged. And this is what we're probably going to see play out in the coming months.
Katie Watson. It was described as simply an equipment failure, but the consequences were a total collapse of electricity generation in Nigeria with widespread blackouts. It's not the first big problem with electricity supplies in a country that's a major exporter of oil and gas. Last year, the grid collapsed four times. I asked our reporter Nkechi Ogbonna in Lagos what had happened and how widespread it had been.
As far as we know, the national grid collapsed at about 5 a.m. We do not know what the cause of that national collapse was, but a lot of distribution companies had sent out messages to consumers stating that there was power outage and they would restore power once the national grid was rectified.
And how long did that take?
It took a couple of hours. In some parts, more than midday. And in some parts, power is just being restored this afternoon. So it's like a gradual restoration across the country.
Now, this was quite an extreme event, even for Nigeria. But on a regular basis, there are random power cuts in various parts of the country on a daily basis, aren't there?
Exactly. Now, sometimes they could run for 12 hours or more, depending on the supply. Sometimes it's ascribed to the low water in the dams that are generating from the hydroelectricity plants. Other times is the gas turbines as well have probably low supply, and so transmission could also be an issue.
Nkechi, how do people adapt to dealing with these power outages that are so unpredictable? How do small businesses cope? How do people cope with their everyday lives?
Well, a lot of small businesses in the country rely on fuel and diesel generators for manufacturing, for production. Alternative sources of energy would have been ideal in terms of solar, but those are very expensive and are not affordable to small business owners and homeowners as well.
That was Nkechi Ogbonna in Lagos. Now, thousands of Syrians have been detained or have gone missing since the start of the uprising in Syria in 2011 and the war that followed. Their families have no idea where they are or whether they're dead or alive. In desperation, they are paying thousands of dollars for information which almost always turns out to be false. Lina Sinjab reports from Turkey, where she meets Syrian refugees searching for news of their missing relatives.
I'm visiting a woman named Malak, a Syrian mother of three sons. Two of them are missing in Syria. Her tiny apartment is in the suburbs of Istanbul. She scrolls through her phone showing me photos of the two brothers who she hasn't seen since they were arrested by the Syrian authorities 11 years ago.
This is her elder son before he was arrested.
He's just very young and with brown hair and little moustache.
This is the younger son, Maher, just before his arrest. And he's too young to face all of this. He's too young.
The United Nations estimates that 100,000 Syrians have been imprisoned and have disappeared since the beginning of Syria's uprising in 2011. It became a civil war as President Assad's brutal regime cracked down on unarmed protesters, killing and arresting thousands of them. Malak's older son was detained after deserting the army in 2012, and she's heard nothing since. Malak and her youngest son left Syria in 2017 to start a new life in Turkey, home now to more than 3 million Syrian refugees. She, like many, has paid middlemen to try to find out about her missing sons.
They take one word from you and create a story. So they make you more interested and you want to pay more so that you get information. But in most cases, they are just lying and extracting your money for nothing.
There is an assumption that paying bribes is the only way to get anything done in Syria.
My name is Riyad Avlar, co-founder in the Association of Detainees and Missing in Saydnaya Prison.
Saydnaya Prison is one of the most notorious in Syria. And Riyad, who's actually Turkish, was detained there for criticizing the government while a student. His family heard nothing about him for 15 years. When he was eventually released, he and a fellow prisoner set up this organization in the southern Turkish city of Gaziantep to help former detainees and the Syrian relatives of the missing. Riyad is concerned that desperate families are paying large sums for information and receive nothing genuine in return.
Most of them told us $5,000, $10,000. Even a family, they sold their houses to pay the middleman.
The amount can be even higher.
I got tortured in the most cruel and brutal way. We even experienced sexual torture. We were taken to places I did not imagine we had in Syria.
Muhammad Abdus Salam is traumatized by the torture he experienced in prison in Syria. He was arrested after taking part in a peaceful protest in Idlib against the government. In 2014, his family was given a death certificate saying he died of a heart attack, but his father refused to believe it.
My father, God bless his soul, paid huge sums of money, more than $40,000 or $50,000, to try and get me out. He got in touch with the broker. I was released with the help of this guy.
For Mohammed's family, paying did actually work. So is Riyadh's NGO right to deter people from doing this? Yes, he says.
Most of them is from the intelligence itself. And the others, maybe they are working together.
So they are either representative of the security apparatus themselves or somebody with connection to them.
Of course. Let me say, they're working as a web.
The United Nations has recently voted for the creation of an independent institution to tackle the issue of the missing in Syria. We asked the Syrian government whether they would be cooperating with this and for their response to the fact that 100,000 people are missing. We have had no reply.
And you can hear more on this story on assignment here on the BBC World Service. Still to come on the Global News podcast, NASA says it's going to try to find out if UFOs exist. And in doing so,
shift the conversation from sensationalism to science to make sure that information is shared transparently around the world.
Italy's Interior Ministry says nearly 7,000 migrants who've crossed from North Africa have arrived on the island of Lampedusa in the last 2 days. That is more than the island's resident population. Well, the local mayor has called a state of emergency, calling for assistance. With more details, here's our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
The Italian Red Cross has told the BBC that most of the recent arrivals are from sub-Saharan and Northern Africa. Weather conditions have been favourable, with most of the boats arriving from Tunisia, the nearest point on the African coast. A Red Cross spokeswoman said providing assistance to such large numbers of people had been challenging, but she said by the end of Friday, more than 4,000 people should have been transferred to Sicily and other destinations in Italy. The politics of the situation remain complex and volatile. One Italian minister alleged, without providing evidence, that the landings were organised, describing them as an act of war.
Danny Eberhardt. NASA is on a mission to find signs of unidentified life. The space agency commissioned a study last June into UFOs, or UAPs, unidentified anomalous phenomena, as it now prefers to call them, and has been giving a briefing into more than 800 unexplained events that have been collected over 27 years. Some of the world's leading data and AI scientists worked on this study. Here's NASA's chief, Bill Nelson, outlining its aims.
First, to examine how NASA can use our expertise and instruments to study UAP from a scientific perspective. Second, shift the conversation about UAP from sensationalism to science. And whatever we find or whatever we recommend, to make sure that information is shared transparently around the world.
Our North America correspondent Nomia Iqbal was at the NASA briefing in Washington.
When we went into the conference, of course, people get quite excited about anything to do with UFOs. They think that, is NASA going to reveal something huge? Are we going to find out that there's life on another planet or anything like that? But of course, it's nothing of the sort. And they said that this is about them being more transparent about what they know and what they don't know. And they say they just don't have enough data to understand what's out there.
And Nomia, you mentioned the need for transparency in the minds of NASA. And that, I imagine, to a certain extent, is to do with what happened earlier on in the year as well, because there was an awful lot of comment in a congressional hearing about a lack of transparency.
That's right. Back in June, there were former military officers who gave really stunning evidence, or stunning testimony, I should say, about UFOs, about alien life, accusing the US government, in a nutshell, of covering something up. Now, our team did put that to Mr. Nelson, and he sort of questioned the credibility of specifically one of the witnesses and saying, look, all I want is facts, just give me evidence. But there's no denial that there is a huge spike in interest in UAPs, as they call them, and they want to work closely with the government. They want to work closely with the military to try and understand UAPs more.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Because I can't remember it being this high profile for a very, very long time. Is that purely, do you think, because of the number of sightings going on?
I think it's a lot to do with that. There's also the congressional hearing that you mentioned as well. If you remember back to earlier in the year, the alleged Chinese spy balloons as well. I just think there's always been that fascination, hasn't there? And I said to Mr. Nelson, you have rebranded this UAP. You're not using the term UFO. They want to broaden the definition of it, but it's also to destigmatize it. And I said to him, people use the term UFOs. I have to be honest, even when I'm saying UAPs, I get confused. Is it UAP, UPA? Because you want to say UFOs. And that's how the American public are. That's how people are globally. And he laughed, Mr. Nelson. He said, people will always have that sort of fantasy, Indiana Jones. I also mentioned the X-Files has probably done a lot of damage as well, which he laughed at. But NASA, it's a really ambitious objective of theirs to try and take all that sensationalism and turn it into something scientific.
That was Nomia Iqbal. The French supermarket Carrefour has put warning labels on products that are guilty of so-called shrinkflation. This is when an item has become smaller in size, but the cost has gone up. The supermarket says the labels are to help shoppers, but that the move is also intended to pressure suppliers like Unilever and Nestle to rethink their pricing. From Paris, here's Hugh Schofield.
In these times of very high inflation, a very interesting phenomenon here in France, the giant supermarket chain Carrefour, one of the biggest in the country, is sticking it to the food industry in a very public way. We're in the soft drinks section, and next to a quite well-known brand of soft drink, there is a sign that says shrinkflation. This product has seen its quantity go down while the tariff you pay for what it contains has gone up. In other words, you are paying the same or more and you're getting less. Now, quite clearly, Carrefour is doing this in order to show that it is on the side of the consumers. So how do they feel?
I think it's a great initiative. It's important to inform the consumers about what is happening so they can make informed choices.
It's great that Carrefour are doing this. Life is very expensive now. So if I see the price of something going up while the quantity goes down, I'm not going to buy it.
I think that Carrefour has been aware of the issue for months, if not before. I mean, the orange juice, they've been sold in a 900 millimeters package for maybe 3-4 years.
Now, the food industry is not taking this accusation lying down. It's pointed out that the number of products singled out by Carrefour for this shrinkflation treatment is actually tiny, which is perfectly true. Rather more pointedly, a consumer affairs group has accused the supermarket of hypocrisy. That 99-cent bag of potatoes in the cut price section still costs 99 cents, but there are now rather fewer potatoes inside it.
Hugh Schofield reporting. Now, have a listen to this.
Don't sit here and lecture us. Don't sit here and lecture us, Mr. McAdams. We shut him down.
I'm not talking. It's the other guy who's talking. I haven't been able to say a word.
Well, that is the kind of fiery debate that takes place almost every evening on Indian television. But now the presenters themselves have come under fire. Members of the main opposition alliance in India have decided to boycott television presenters who they say are legitimising hate-filled rhetoric in the country. The alliance accused the presenters of favouring the governing Hindu BJP Nationalist Party and not giving enough media coverage to the opposition Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi. One of the presenters being boycotted is Arnab Goswami. Here's his response.
And I want to say to them today, as they bring out this ridiculous boycott threat, bring it on. The people of this country are with us, with me. We have the nation on our side because the nation is with Republic, and Republic does not compromise.
Our South Asia editor, Ambrosan Etarajan, tell me more about why the opposition alliance has taken the decision.
So what we heard in the first clip about guests talking over each other and the presenter yelling is only tip of the iceberg. If you watch some of these television channel debates in India in the evening, people really get angry day in and day out. The civility that has gone. Now, this has become a real issue for opposition because what happened in the last 9 years after the Hindu nationalist BJP came to power? See, the job of a journalist to hold people in power accountable, but then the television debates were only questioning the opposition parties and whatever Rahul Gandhi, the leader of the Congress party, was doing, the twist the speech. And most importantly, it's all about hateful rhetoric against minorities, against Muslims and Christians. Now, the opposition alliance says they have earmarked these 14 presenters on their shows. We are not going to go because they are not impartial. They are favoring a particular political party. They are threatening the social fabric of the country. And that is what the opposition alliance has decided.
So how's the governing BJP and all these media organizations, how have they reacted to this?
The Digital Broadcasters Association say, you know, this is a threat to the freedom of press, quite unprecedented because you are boycotting a certain number of television presenters, which means you're not able to put forward the other views. So it sends out a very strong message in terms of freedom of expression. And the BJP, the governing party, they have strongly condemned. But on the other side, for example, if BBC calls the BJP spokesperson, they would not talk to us because they view BBC as anti-national and putting views against the interests of India. There are two different arguments here. It's for the television presenters now to come out with what kind of answers they are going to give to this.
Ambarasan Etarajan. Now, one of Australia's richest men has apologised after saying that unemployment should rise to remind arrogant workers of their place. Tim Gurner had claimed the COVID pandemic had changed employees' attitudes to work for the worse. He now says he deeply regrets the remarks, but as Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, that hasn't stopped the backlash.
And federal MPs have slammed millionaire property developer Tim Gurner after he accused workers of being arrogant.
Australia's TV news headlines have been dominated by a tycoon whose remarks have been condemned as shocking and offensive. On Tuesday, Tim Gurner said that the pandemic had made workers lazy.
People decided that they didn't really want to work so much anymore through COVID, and that has had a massive issue on productivity. And we need to see that change. We need to see unemployment rise. Unemployment has to jump 40-50%, in my view. We need to see pain in the economy. We need to remind people that they work for the employer, not the other way around.
A 40-50% rise in Australia's unemployment rate would see more than 200,000 people lose their jobs. Tim Gurner has apologised for his comments, but the fury they've ignited in the Australian media and beyond shows no sign of abating.
What an extremely obnoxious human being. Is he an employer or a zookeeper, that guy?
It's crazy, huh?
Tim Gurner has had some support in the business community. It's not the first time he's lit the fuse on controversy. He made headlines in 2017 when he suggested young people couldn't afford to buy a home because they were spending too much on avocado toast and didn't work enough.
That was Phil Mercer. Now, have you heard about the sharks on a golf course? It's not the start of a joke, but the subject of an academic study, no less, that has just been published in the journal Marine and Fishery Sciences. For the last 20 years, sharks have been living in a lake on a golf course near Brisbane in Queensland, Australia. And they've been able to survive surprisingly well in water far less salty than they are used to. Scott Wagstaff is the general manager of Carbrook Golf Club. He told Evan Davis how the sharks ended up there.
We've got a couple of big river systems next to our golf course, and what happens when it rains a lot is these rivers flood and inundate the golf course. And then in this case, we've got a really big lake that was the result of sand mining. It's 21 hectares in size, and so the river comes over, dumps a few sharks in, and then it recedes and leaves them there, and they grew up in this big lake. And yeah, that's sort of how it all happened at the start.
And these are right next to the golf course.
Oh yeah, you have to play alongside the lake on a number of holes. Back in the day when they were seen a lot, you know, it was quite common for golfers to be just walking along, minding their own business, playing their golf, and then see a shark fin sort of cruising only a few meters away from them.
How dangerous are the bull sharks?
They are very dangerous when you're in the water. Fortunately, with us, the golfers stay on the land and the sharks stay in the water, and we haven't had a problem.
This is not salt water in the lake, but these are saltwater sharks. So this is why scientists have been quite interested in the experience of this community.
It's not fresh water, it's brackish water. So it's in the middle where we're about 6 kilometres from the ocean. So the water has a high salinity, even though it's sort of in that middle part.
But the sharks seem to be fine. They've got the fish in the lake, obviously, so they've got food and stuff.
Yeah, it just sort of became its own little ecosystem for a very long time. And lots of fish in there, and the sharks were happy. It was all you can eat, pretty much. And they just grew up in their little happy environment. And so for the best part of 20 years, they just swam around and ate fish and scared golfers.
And I understand that you did occasionally throw some meat in just to give them a little treat.
I did, yes. More for camera action. I sort of had a little spot where I could put meat in the water, and a couple of sharks were very well trained, and they would come in and appear, you know, almost within 5 or 10 minutes. So, yeah, I got to see them quite a lot. They'd come in and eat the meat very gently, not aggressively, and take the meat and off they'd go.
What's happened to the sharks?
They were in there for a very long time, and from what we understand, they sort of probably got a little bit old, and we had a bit of trouble with fishermen coming in at night time and trying to hook them up, and we lost a couple that way, and just through various interactions with the lake, they've just basically got to the end of their life. We're not really sure if the rivers have brought in some new life or the lake's empty, but I wouldn't be going swimming in there just yet.
Have you managed to use this as a marketing ploy for your golf course?
Yeah, probably accidentally. YouTube and social media has helped us become a little bit better known than maybe we should be, and the club's changed its logo. Now we've got a little bit of a shark sort of feel to our logo, and I reckon we've squeezed a few miles out of our sharks, that's for sure.
Scott Wagstaff speaking to Evan Davis. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Holly Palmer, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.